shouts of space.
Hello, this is Diana, and I'm with the Mindcore Podcast.
Hello, I'm Psychonaut. This is our show, and what the purpose of this show is to create a science popularization show, or a show that reports about science to a different culture of society than maybe the kind of people that would read Discover Magazine or National Geographic, but might prefer more juxtaposed magazine. People who are into art movements, independent art movements, you know, underground music, revolutionaries, badasses, rock and rollers. We want to be your science journalism. And on today's episode of the podcast, we're going to take that stroll into a topic that I think many people are going to find fascinating, which is love dolls. But you're kind of the scholar on this one.
I am a love doll nerd. A love doll is a doll that was made for the purpose of, glorified masturbation. And, what a real doll is a lifelike substitute for a sexual partner. You could say really glorified, extravagant masturbation.
Well, I think what most people may be thinking of is the old school blow up doll that was so ridiculous that you even see it on sitcoms.
Yeah, or at bachelorette parties in public. Yeah, no, they're not sexy.
No, not at all. They don't look like real women. They look ridiculous. They look like balloons. As a man, I mean, no disrespect to anyone who's into that, but sometimes I feel a little embarrassed that men are the gender that uses the blow up doll. But, my friends who like synthetic sex have taken it to a whole new level. They make ultra-realistic, sculpture-quality female replicas.
Yeah, and the amount of artistry and the amount of, engineering?
Yes, because the people say they feel like real sex.
Yeah, and their joints are flexible. They're made out of sophisticated blends of silicone. Each individual one is an art piece that's customizable for the purchaser.
Yeah, absolutely. And it gets to a more fascinating level. And this is where Diana and I really, I think, got synergetic about this topic, is that I'm really into AI, and a post-human future where we really start to become machines. I have a neuroscience degree. I'm not a professional scientist, but the whole time I was studying neuroscience, my kind of one reoccurring vision for the field of neuroscience is that we can begin progressively to, we are already extending life mm-hmm. through science. 75 years ago, the average age of death was a lot less, decades less than it is now. We continue to expand on this trend more than likely, and I believe that at some point we start to deliberately become machines. Glasses are kind of primitive, cybernetic. They're artificial eyes on some level. We have, for quadriplegics, we've developed microchip implants that allows the quadriplegic to operate a mouse with their thoughts. I mean, we have great technology, and I believe if we continue on this trend, eventually we will become more like robots. And robots will also be emergent in that same, part of human evolution. And I think these guys that are fucking their love dolls, especially the one we interviewed today, who's a wonderful man, Dave Cat, I think that they're kind of the pioneers, psychological pioneers of what it will be like to live with robots and to have robots really be a part of our lives. But there's the obvious, concern that this may be the most overt example of sexism of human history. Of course, they probably have existed since prehistory. Masturbation devices.
Surely. It's an interesting question because, the love dolls are very synthetic looking. They have perfect titties. They're perfectly symmetrical. They're cast from a mold. That's an idealized mold. And so that becomes one of those questions like, how does that affect the female onlooker as far as how standards are met?
Yeah, I mean, it's true. We know that in societies where sexism is very prominent, women are treated as property. They're seen as subhuman. And it's a concern that you know, among many things, that'll promote that kind of thinking in men, or maybe even that it proves that men have that kind of thing intrinsically built in.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting question. And, you know, there's also other concerns, but there is one line of dolls that has sparked my attention. They're purposefully made to look like cartoons, to look like manga. And they're called boy toy dolls. And as a matter of fact, one line of them looks exactly like Team America World Police to me. But they're highly stylized. Their features are childlike. They have very large eyes, very small noses. Some of them are made to look at like anime, and they have like these really retarded bubble tits, and then they're extremely, extremely thin through their hips. So it's kind of like almost, I don't know.
Well, and also in
pedophiliac.
I do know a lot about Japanese manga porn. In Japan, sexual attitudes are very different than they are in the United States. And you know, and the Japanese have had a very sexually civilized culture probably before we even did in the West. That they would write textbooks on sex while the Catholic Church was burning people for enjoying it. You know, it's a you got to give them respect. But in the manga, it's not unusual to see children having sex or even full blown like full frontal pedophilia. Rape is extremely common, and. And, you know, so there is kind of a whole genre of that already that has a strong market in the United States. I urge anyone who's curious that goes to the Comic-Con to go to the Eros booth and see what people are buying.
So do you think that's a distraction for people who are already inclined in that direction, or do you think it creates inclination?
I think that may be one of the most important scientific questions facing people who really want to do something about pedophilia, because we don't understand very well how pedophiles are made. I mean, I took a sex psychology class in my degree. It was not that long ago. That was in that course, and they said that they had seen kind of a correlational evidence that there tended to be like early childhood brain injury was common among pedophiles. You know, I don't know. Of course, and you think about the Greek pederasty, and you know that it has been institutionalized in certain parts in history. And I've read articles, you know, about, you know, pedophilia with Tibetan Buddhist monks and Catholic priests. So it's weird. We don't know. We don't really know why it is. And you know, I'm as disgusted and as angered by pedophilia as anyone, but I wonder how much truth there is to the idea that it's a clinical problem.
Well, regardless of what some pedophilias may or may not do with love dolls, that's a small fraction of the people who enjoy them, and that's the same kind of extremist argument that people who are anti-gay marriage make, so it's not fair, but it is an interesting mm-hmm. point. But today we're going to interview a person who I think probably has the most healthy synthetic relationship. I don't know.
No, this guy is I am so glad that Dave Catt made it to popular culture where people like can know about him. He was in the movie Guys and Dolls, which is a BBC documentary, and I think, did you see him in that documentary or did you see another one?
I saw him in Guys and Their Dolls.
And there's also a French documentary in which he was featured. Dave Catt is actually married to his real doll. And he has a very complex, like, almost like psychologically abstract lifestyle going on with his love doll. And he is definitely, I would say, a post-humanist, robotics enthusiast, robotics advocate, robotics popularizer. He has his blog, what is it called? Shouting at the Echoes?
Yes.
And we'll have it linked. And he... And his blog is like, if you think robots are interesting, and if you want to know what kind of cool things are happening with robots, his blog is a great place to go.
Yeah, absolutely. And you could definitely tell that he's just kind of cyberpunk to an extreme, I suppose.
Yeah, well, we definitely, if I didn't feel like people might not get it if we called this a cyberpunk podcast, that's what I would call it.
Yeah, it is interesting, but with Dave Katz's doll, she does have, like, a distinct personality. And it's...
Yes, she's an elaborate character that he keeps up in his own mind so he can have a relationship with her. And I've also been reading a book by Franz De Waals. He's a primatologist called The Age of Empathy, which I recommend. And he talks about how kind of like we're just biologically predisposed to experience emotional empathy with just the image of human beings.
That is to say, human-like things.
What do you mean a human-like thing?
Well, the thing is all mammals have a certain type of cell in their brain. They're called mirror neurons. And what mirror neurons do, and this is just one aspect of the phenomena, there's a lot that's built into it, but what mirror neurons do is when a mammal sees something that resembles itself, it begins to build a map, an internal map of that other thing's body. So like when people, when we're talking to each other, we have this funny thing that social psychologists know about that we'll start to mimic each other's postures, hand gestures, how the legs are moving. We know that mirror neurons, what they do is they cause you to basically map into yourself what the other person is doing. We can also have this kind of mirror neuron interaction in between species. That's what Franz De Waals observed and he wrote about in his book. And it stands to reason because of the way mirror neurons work, because they would work with a mirror image, which is not a real being, that they should also work with like a statue.
And what are the purpose, evolutionarily speaking, of mirror neurons?
Well, it's kind of a social bond-building thing. It's for me, what it reminds me of is actually kind of like how insect colonies have these pheromones that allow them to like lock in as part of the same hive. I think this is mammals' version of the same thing, but that's just my own like analogy from what I've read.
Oh, like how bees do a dance or yeah. Whatever. Is that even true? Do bees really do a dance for each other?
Yeah. They communicate with that kind of stuff. And the ants use pheromones. I'm sure there are pheromones involved in the bee dance. And we also have pheromone communication. But that with the mirror neurons work by sight. And sight can be deceived.
Let us bee dance now. So, yeah, all these things are interesting as far as AI goes. And I think I read it in a Chuck Palahniuk book, but he said that, like, porn aficionados or people that were purchasing things for the sake of sexual gratification were early adapters, and that you can pretty much guess what the new cool technology is going to be based on what people who are really into porn buy. Do you think that's true?
Well, I mean, that's an empirical question. I hope that the next edition of Freakonomics has...
we should write it into him, ask him that.
The porno predictor effect.
Yeah. So maybe the fact that people are
the
doing
internet,
it for sexual gratification.
The internet certainly has had, like, strides that were porn-driven.
Yeah, that's the whole purpose that why you can buy things over the internet started with porn. Yeah, the people who made that software, that was that movie, yeah.
Oh, man, that's really fascinating. Well, so that's really the angle that Dave Katz takes with the whole thing. He'll say all this in the interview, but this is kind of the mind frame that we're coming at this from. I mean, it's that having a love doll, one of these superhuman, like replicas, is... to a certain extent, a psychological experiment.
I agree. He's like a cowboy out on the frontier of sex robots.
Yes.
No, he's actually, he's extremely intelligent and thoughtful, and that's why we wanted to talk to him specifically, because I'm sure there are thousands of people who... Real Dolls is one particular brand of synthetic dolls. there's many, many different ones. But real dolls are kind of the ones that are famous because they were in that documentary.
Well, and they have conventions. We'll learn from the interview. If you go to Dave Capp's website, you'll find out that this whole idea of having such a lifelike sex toy, or even people falling in love with robots and that kind of thinking, is popular in fiction in Japan and more socially acceptable than it is in the U.S. I think that's we don't want to be limited by social stigma, and because so many things that we now enjoy, that normal people enjoy in society, have in the past been stigmatized. That we had resistance to technology. There's still technophobia. We have had resistance to understanding the place of the Earth and the solar system. We have had we are having resistance to the basic theory of biology, which is evolution. So you don't want to be narrow-minded, because you don't know what the future is going to bring. You don't know what, as we learn more about ourselves and nature, what we're going to transform into.
If you want to know about the first time I ever heard about real dolls, it's a very embarrassing story.
Well, you're the one who's really schooled me on the topic. I'm pontificating, but you really are the expert.
The first time I ever heard about a real doll was because I was reading an article about Marilyn Manson. So if I still liked Marilyn Manson, I must have been 13 years old. Date me as you will. Anyway, so if I was 13, that would have been the first time I read about it, because I distinctly remember reading an article that said that his next album was delayed because he spent $6,000 on a sex doll that had a skeletal system.
Well, it's funny that you bring up Marilyn Manson, because I debated whether or not I should bring this up in the podcast. I read all of the Anton LaVey, like, Satanist books. Anton LaVey was the founder of the Church of Satan, which is this, I hopefully not wouldn't offend any Satanists that might be listening, to say it's a pseudo-religion, or a synthetic religion, if you will. And Anton LaVey, towards the end, his number one thing that he wanted people who were into his philosophy to do was to make artificial human companions.
Ooh, I love that correlation. It's fun.
So it is fun that Marilyn Manson would write. He was very enthusiastic. One of the songs on Antichrist Superstar is very overtly about his fantasy to have an artificial human companion. The one that I can't remember the name of the song, where he talks about her being made of, like, gross stuff. And in the video, he has these dolls in cages.
Oh, that song is called Tourniquet.
Yeah, he's always been into that, and that, I think, probably primed me to being more, and having read all that stuff, to being more open-minded about the idea. I mean, I neither advocate nor condemn.
Oh, hail Satan.
Welcome to the we would like to welcome to the Mindcore podcast, Dave Catt, a famous gentleman. Tell me the name of your blog again, Dave Catt. Oh.
That would be Shouting to Hear the Echoes.
Okay, so we are here to introduce Dave Catt, who is internationally known for the BBC documentary Guys and Dolls, and he has a wonderful blog about basically robotics and artificial humans. Called Shouting in the Echoes. Is it .com?
Well, it's actually www.kuronekochan. I'm going to have to spell that out, because nobody's going to get it.
Well, that's going to be linked.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Post a link.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, basically, if you like just hop on Google and type in Shouting to Hear the Echoes, then that's going to be the first and only hit that you really get. But, it goes on about dolls, robotics, androids, gynoids, synthetics, concerts I've seen, concerts I've missed, and there is.
We've noticed you and Diana and I all have similar taste in music. I have your blog on my favorites.
Oh God, guys, I'm flattered. You know, if you've got your blog, if you've got my blog on your favorites, that means you don't really do a lot of blogging.
Oh no, I do.
Thank you. I'm flattered. It's good to finally meet both of you.
Well, I guess probably the first thing we should open up with, because this seems to be like the way you've penetrated the general public the most, is with the BBC documentary. Is that the only documentary that you've been featured in?
Actually, the BBC documentary was... I actually have to think about this. That was the second documentary we were in. The first one we had done for French public television back in 2001 is called Yves de Silicones.
Oh.
And it's like I said, this is back in 2001, so this is like pre-YouTube, and I've got like a copy, and I'm sure the director has a copy, and I'm sure those are the only people that have copies, because nobody knows about it. And then we were also filmed by an amateur filmmaker, let's say 2005, 2004, for a documentary that she was doing called, theoretically it was going to be called The Mechanical Bride, and it's like in production hell. It's been in production hell for the past 5 years, really. And then we recently did the National Geographic Taboo thing last year. That was fun in and of itself.
Oh, I'll have to see that episode. I haven't seen the Taboo episode either. I did see the Guys and Dolls documentary. So for the listeners who don't know, it's basically it's a documentary about love dolls, which are basically like in general, like the general public conception of them is that they're like, you know, very, very realistic, artificial women that men use at a minimum for sex. But they're a whole lot more than that to you. At least Shishan is, right, Dave Cat?
Yes. It's like, I'm not going to lie, it did start out as a sexual thing. But then it's, the way I treat it is, it's like any relationship. If you start out with the sex, you start out being attracted to each other, and then it blossoms, you know, to use a corny term, into like, you know, a relationship where it's like, well, she's there for me, I'm there for her, she depends on me, I depend on her in my way. And it's, you know, it's, and that's the thing about dolls. It's, they can be really anything you want them to be. They can be high-end sex toys, or, you know, they can be companions. And I think that's, it depends on the imagination of the user, really.
So, could you explain to us a little more about, because, I mean, you're not, you understand that Shishan is, you know, she was made in a factory, she doesn't have a nervous system, unless you've installed one that I don't know about.
You know, if I could do that sort of thing, I wouldn't be working where I'm working now, let's just say that.
But tell us, like, about how your mental relationship with Shishan started, because when I've tried to tell people about you, they seem to have a difficult time understanding how you can have gone with a real doll to the point where she has a favorite band, where my favorite scene in the BBC documentary is that it shows you meticulously, lovingly, carefully dressing Shishan, putting makeup on her to make her look presentable. When you put her in the crate, I felt horrible that she was being put in a crate.
Yeah.
Like, I wanted to see Shishan sitting in an airplane seat, you know, and I'm not, you know.
Glass, you know, get a little packs of peanuts.
No, right, because you had put so much, like, you had projected so much empathy in that scene, and then the guy, the repair guy, gets her, and he's surprised by the makeup. Like, it gets on his hand, and he's like, what the hell?
Yeah, that, I didn't expect that to happen either. I think, I don't know what Slave was expecting, but he's just like, yeah, when he bumps it off on his hand, he's just like, oh, well.
Well, what that shows is that you have achieved a psychological depth of your experience with Shishan that is not typical for the real doll user.
Yeah, I mean, again, it depends on the person that has the doll, but it's just like, I mean, Shishan isn't just a partner. It's just the fact that, like, Shishan really is a character I've developed over the course of, you know, like 10 years of us being together. It's yeah, I mean, there's the aspect, the I guess, mental, fantastical aspect of, like, yeah, she's my partner, she's my lover, et cetera, et cetera. But then, you know, I like to think I have one foot in reality and say, yes, she is a doll. But then, you know, taking the fact that she is doll, it's, I just think it's limiting to have something like a beautiful human-shaped object and just treat it as a thing. So I'm like, well, you know, why not give this thing a personality and make it more than a thing?
Well, aren't all of them custom made by a sculptor, a professional sculptor who actually started out in the arts and like just purely in the arts?
Yeah, basically Matt McMullen had started out like he'd started out in a special effects studio in California. And he graduated from that, kind of struck out on his own, and then he started making, like, miniature dolls, maybe, I want to say, like, maybe, no, Barbie height, basically. And they're articulated and whatnot, very detailed. And they decided to scale up to, like, you know, 1-1 scale. But the thing is, he was just making them as mannequins. He didn't make them as, like, you know, sexual objects or toys, that sort of thing. And eventually, you know, someone caught wind of this, and he's just like, well, can you make one of these where you can have sex with them? And that really wasn't the first thing on Matt's mind. He was just like, well, yeah, I guess I can. And, you know, that kind of spread like wildfire. And apparently he was kind of sort of reluctant at first, but then, like, his wife at the time kind of pushed him into it. He's like, yeah, well, you know, if people be willing to pay for this sort of thing, then why not make them? And it's kind of exploded from there.
Well, I know that Diana has some questions. I'm hogging the interview.
Yeah, you are. I forgive you, though. Okay, well, as a woman, I have some, like, natural, like, kind of questions that arise for me. But I guess my first question is, if Shishan could wake up tomorrow sentient, is that something you would want?
Yes. Yes. I mean, my goal, really, I mean, I guess you could say a doll is kind of a stopgap for me. I would rather have a gynoid, a fully walking, talking, autonomous gynoid than a doll. Because, you know, a doll, you know, life with a doll is reciprocal. I mean, she can't move back. She can't move on her own. She can't move here. Mm-hmm. But if she could wake up and actually say, you know, you're hogging the blankets, give me those, that sort of thing, that would be, I don't think I'd be going to work that day, I'll tell you that. But, you know, that's the goal, really. You know, it's just like have artificial. That's why I use the term synthetic, because it doesn't just mean doll. It also means, like, you know, humanoid robots. And I'm trying to get people used to the whole concept of that. Like, well, you know, in the next couple of decades, we will have humanoid robots that, you know, may not start out looking as good as dolls of any manufacturers, but eventually they will.
And you think that's a reality, that we will have, maybe not sentient, but definitely, like, sentient enough type sex dolls available?
Yeah, I think that's honestly going to happen. I mean, in the past, I want to say 5 years, in Japan, there's been, like, ridiculously amazing strides with, like, humanoid robot industry. I mean, Hiroshi Ishiguro is, like, one of the foremost roboticists, and he's actually developed the Actroid series. There have been about 5 or 6 versions of those, and with, of course, you know, any iteration of anything, like machine, you know, each version that's newer is different from the last version. And there's another organization, their acronym is AIST, and it stands for something really long, can't remember it. But they've actually made a gynoid that not only talks, but she walks and moves as well. And,
oh, wow.
She was in a fashion show, as a matter of fact. She was originally designed to be a fashion model. She was in a fashion show. She, like, went down a runway displaying some sort of dressing gown that had, like, LEDs in it and whatnot. And about a month or two ago, she was actually in some, it was a thing in Japan, I can't remember, it was called CTAC, it was like a robotic expo. She was actually in a choreographed dance display, which is very impressive.
Yeah.
And as the technology gets better and better, and, you know, when I say, you know, it's only been 5 years, I mean, just thinking about that phrase itself, it's only been 5 years. If it's taken only 5 years to get to that point, you know, you're probably going to be looking at artificial humans, if not necessarily companions, probably reasonably within the next 20 to 30 years.
Well, I'm going to give you 2 little bits of news that I know that I've encountered from reliable sources that I think back up with your saying. There's always Moore's Law, the thing that basically the computational power, like, doubles or it grows in some kind of exponential scale with each generation of a...
Yes, I've heard something along those lines, yeah.
And they say that that to match, like, the operations per second capacity of the human brain, we've got maybe 20 years. And some transhumanists, they call this event the singularity, but I think to build it up to kind of like a 2012 kind of thing is going to end up being anticlimactic. And I say that because of the next bit of news, is I'm told that one of the main things driving the Japanese lifelike humanoid robotics industry is that the Japanese have a negative population growth, and that they actually are looking for comforting, like, robots that, to care for their elderly.
Yep.
And if you want, it would be very easy to piggyback that technology to make robots that are comforting for all humans.
Exactly. Exactly. And, I mean, a lot of these, you know, developments or whatnot are taking place in the Far East because, well, they are more, in Japan, they're more oriented, no pun intended, towards the Shinto mindset, which basically is an animist mindset that says, well, everything, whether inanimate or animate, has some sort of, like, soul or spirit of it. And they're more comfortable with the idea of things like, you know, having their own spirits, I guess for lack of a better term, than we are in the West. And that's what's really driving a lot of the developments over there, as opposed to, like, where we're just bogged down in America, just making, well, if we have to make robots, we have to make them military robots. We have to make them something that kills.
Interesting. I do have another question. Are you trying to, like, seek perfection from your companion by going with a synthetic? Because humans have flaws to their bodies and they have flaws to their personalities. And
yeah.
So is that kind of what you're going for?
Well, I guess in some level, yeah. I mean, I can't lie and say no, but it's the experiences that I've had with women, you know, have been less than ideal. So, it, obviously, I mean, really, anyone would want a partner that is, you know, someone that's going to love them and trust them forever, someone that's never going to lie or cheat to them, you know, it's they want that stability of, like, never having to worry about their partner like stabbing them in the back. And, you know, that's, I think, one of the driving forces between, you know, me wanting to have a synthetic partner is that I would always have someone that would always be there for me that would never turn on me. So.
Do you think that synthetics threaten human identity at all?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know what? I'm going to get a drink because I'm totally tongue-tied. But that's a valid point. Not sponsored by Gabriel. There is a valid fear that people, organic people, are threatened by synthetic people. And I think one of it, luckily I was like actually writing a friend about this sort of thing recently. And one of the reasons, I think, is because you see something that acts human and for all intents and purposes is human, but you know it isn't. And, you know, one of the things that makes us human is the fact that there is a mortality that we as human beings have that synthetics don't. And it just kind of brings some people to the fore that, like, well, you know, this human-looking robot's going to be around, like, however many years after I'm dead. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people are just, like, they don't want to be reminded that, you know, entropy prevails, really. But I think that's kind of irrational, because you think of it this way, that sort of thing is like saying, well, if I have a car, it's also a machine. This thing's never going to break down. It's never going to die. Well, cars break down. Microwaves break down. You know, computers break down. I guess extending that thought, you could also say, well, if a computer breaks down, if, like, the hard drive is unfinished, then you could, like, you know, pull it out and put it into another computer, thereby extending its life, making it, well, immortal in a sense. I mean, you could do that with a synthetic human, but, well, obviously you can't with organic humans. And, I don't know, it's just something really interesting that people can't get past that fact. That, you know, it does, like, make people realize that they are mortal, they won't be forever. But, I mean, we've known that for years, so it's like, I don't see why this should suddenly, like, you know, grab them by the lapels and say, hey, guess what? You know, you got how many years left?
Right. Okay, and I'm going to reveal my deepest, darkest fantasy. Do you think that there's a future where humans and synthetics converge, where we become synthetic, or that we're able to download our consciousness or identity into a synthetic thing that is immortal? Do you think that's possible?
I think it is possible, but personally, I don't think it's... I'll tell you this, I think you'll see purely synthetic humans, like I said, in about 20 to 30 years, doing something like taking a human brain or human consciousness and downloading it into a synthetic body. Maybe 100 years? Maybe? I mean, that's... They're saying now that it's like, you know, the amount of ability the human brain has, it would require ridiculous amounts of terabytes of, like, memory to, like, even match what we've got or what we've currently got going.
I think it's 40 million operations per second, but I'll double-check.
Yeah, see, there you go. Hey, you're more on the statistics than I am. But, yes, it's a ridiculous amount. And, like, trying to, like, put, you know, the equivalent of, like, human consciousness in a synthetic body.
But I don't know how they're getting that number, though, because you got to understand that computational neuroscience is not an, you know, it's a very new pioneering field. They may be saying things are more complicated than they really are. They may be putting philosophical variables into their equation. Like, for example, like, emotion is very mysterious and spiritual until you understand that it's our basest instincts, and that it occurs in the limbic system, which is in the core of the brain, and that information...
That's such romantic.
That information is actually processed in the cortex later, so the first thing you have is this instinctual response before you can start to think. And that and then you make sense of that, and that's how we experience emotions, which is, emotions to me has always kind of seemed like the holy grail of robotics, or AI. But emotion is really, if my reading of it is correct, is really the most grotesque, like, primitive aspect of human consciousness. I mean, I'm not saying I want to get rid of it. I love emotions, and I work very hard to experience them in extremes. But
diving off of a burning plane, that sort of thing.
Well, you know, art is, to a great extent, the pursuit of emotional experience. And art is also, I mean, at its rawest form, like, every time that I draw a picture, no matter how romantically engaged... You know, the more romantically engaged I get with my art, like, you know, being like, this painting has a piece of me in it. That's me with an inanimate object. That's it.
Yeah, I completely agree. And that's the thing. It's just like, I mean, God knows how many sci-fi tropes have been, like, you know, brought up with this sort of thing. Where it's just like, well, you can have a robot that can, like, you know, play a piece of music by Beethoven, or, like, you know, reproduce a Picasso or a Warhol, or that sort of thing, but really, is there any emotion behind it?
You know,
that's the thing. It's just like, since emotion, I mean, it's, yes, it's chemical processes, it's animal instinct, you know, combining to, like, make love or revulsion or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I also like to think of it this way. It's just like, if we can simulate that sort of thing in an artificial person, and it produces the same reaction in, like, you know, other artificial people or organic people, then, you know, if it quacks like a duck, then you might as well call it a duck, you know?
Well, let me come back to some of the stuff Diana was saying earlier, just because I know that if I don't ask you this question, I'm going to catch a lot of hell. is that basically a lot of women, when I talk to them about just the love doll at all, the first reactions are always that it's objectifying women, that men using love dolls, that they are reducing women to the most, like, non-human components that they like about women, and because of that, it makes that it feeds into misogyny, and that it feeds into men depreciating women and doing, like, unconsciously treating them like less like human beings. What do you think about that?
Well, there's valid points, I will agree, but the thing is, for one, I've always said it's, like, it's not an objectification of women, it's more of a feminization of objects, for one. But another, it's not, saying it's just, you know, men treating women like toys is invalid, because the thing is, it's like, Well, I mean, there are male dolls out there, but, you know, people barely hear about male dolls. You know, it's like for every 1,000 people out there that hear about real dolls or dolls in general.
I know there are a whole lot more dildos out there than there are real dolls.
Yeah, see? That's the thing. You know, we could start a case for that. However, you know... But, see, the thing is, it's just like, I don't know, it's, there's, again, the whole feminazi aspect of it, and it's, I hate going back to it because it does seem a misogynistic thing to say, but that's furthest from the truth. But it's just, it's hard to say. Well, these have said it's hard to say. That's the thing, it's like some people would treat dolls or gynoids, if they existed on the consumer market, as things. I mean, there's no such person as, like, the stereotypical doll owner. I mean, there's no such person as, I guess you could say, the stereotypical technosexual. You know, there are going to be people who have artificial companions as just, you know, toys, slaves, that sort of thing. You know, it depends on the person. But it's not misogynistic because there's, like, a lot of people, such as myself, that treat my doll as human, I guess you could say. I mean, there's a reductionist aspect, I guess you could say, the whole thing of, man, I'm just losing my train of thought. I'm filled with food right now.
Basically, what you were getting to is that, for one, it's a little bit stereotyping the real doll user, that it's basic, yeah. And this came through very clearly to me in the BBC documentary, because for one, you yourself, like, the first thing I tell people, like, when I'm talking about you and they have that reaction to the real doll is, no, you don't understand, this guy Dave Cat, he loves his doll, he dresses her up, he puts makeup on her, she has a favorite, Shishan and I actually have the same favorite band. Unless it's changed, it's Joy Division, is it not?
She loves Joy Division. In fact, if she could meet Peter Hook, that would be awesome.
Well, maybe we'll have to build a Peter Hook robot.
There you go.
And the thing, too, is that, like, I mean, you know, you do get criticisms. I get criticisms. I'm sure, and with your friends, there have been criticisms of those who own dolls.
And it's just like, you know, my circle of friends, personally, they think of Shichan as a person in and of herself. It's like, I've got friends who are constantly like, oh, yeah, how's it going, Dave Cat? You know, and how's Shidore doing? You know, they'll always ask how she's doing. You know, I've actually had people say, oh, yeah, I've seen him treat his doll, and I've seen a lot of my friends treat their spouses. So, I don't know what kind of marriages those are.
Well, no, you have an exemplary devotion and adoration. I just read this book called The Age of Empathy by Franz de Waal. He's a primatologist. I would recommend this book to all the listeners and to you in particular, Dave Cat, because I believe I got a lot of insight about your particular relationship with Shishan. It basically, he talks about how empathy works, like, throughout the phylogenetic chain, like, throughout evolution. And really, it's basically you see something that looks like you, and your brain starts to compute like it was a part of that thing.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, one of the great detractor arguments of, like, those who are against, like, you know, synthetics in general is just like, oh, well, you know, that looks creepy. But it's like, you know, even if you're into, like, dolls or gynoids, that sort of thing, seeing a picture is not the same as actually seeing one in person. And, yeah, there's going to be a lot of, like, mammalian triggers that start firing off, especially once you see one in person going, wow.
And it is a uniquely mammalian phenomenon, so it's interesting that you were aware of that.
Yeah.
Like, that's actually, like, one of the main things that separates us from reptiles and amphibians, who we generally consider to be our phylogenetic predecessors. It's just an interesting thing.
Well, yeah, and I did want to ask you about the uncanny valley, that theory that if something looks too close like a human, that it starts to, like, creep you out. And there's something about that is unsettling. What makes you think that you're immune? Or are you immune? Is Shichan just barely unrealistic enough to not be creepy? Or
that's the thing, too. It's just like, there are, you know, going from, like, the idolater community, there, you could say that there are a lot of doll owners that have dolls, and if they had a choice, if their doll were an actual organic human, they would, you know, that's what they would want. But then there are those of us who, if we had a choice if between, like, our doll being an organic or, like, a synthetic, like, you know, a gynoid, then we go for the gynoid option. Personally, I think I'm immune to the uncanny valley, because it's just, like, the things that people find creepy, I'm not going to say everything that I find, you know, interesting is, you know, that's what I think. But it's just, the whole uncanny valley, I think, well, for one, it's not really a proven theory. It's David Hansen, who's a roboticist, and I think the closest thing we have in the United States to Hiroshi Ishiguro, has said himself, you know, people, the uncanny valley is basically, it's a theory, but people treat it like it's hard science. And it's been tested, you know, but it hasn't really been proven. It depends on the person. You know, a lot of people are just like, well, you know, the closer a robot gets to a human, it's unsettling. I don't really get any of that with dolls or gynoids in general. I'll tell you this, there's, going back to Hiroshi Ishiguro again, he's developed a robot, I can't remember what it's called, look on YouTube. It's like this, it looks like an infant, it's gray. It's not the big gray toddler one, but it's like, it's an infant, there's a torso, and there's like these suggestions of arms and like no legs. They like kind of end at a point. It looks a bit like Casper the Friendly Ghost. I guess that's the closest thing it looks to. That I find creepy. You know? I guess maybe it's like the whole, it's...
Well, you know, you want to know something that just comes to my mind while we're talking about this is the furries. You're like a... You're familiar with the Chan culture, I'm sure, and probably even more than I am. And furries are a very elusive group for people who are not, like, already integrated. Like, I find it's very, you know, I surfed all kinds of internet pornography to try to find, like, real-life images of Yifing, and they always have these, like, they prefer to represent themselves in computer art.
Yeah.
And I think
there's probably legal precedent for that.
for the furries. Well, the furries don't have sex with animals. They just see that they project themselves as anthropomorphic animals. And I'm, and you bring up this Casper, and I'm like, once we reach that threshold where we can have these really sophisticated, like, companion robots, furries are going to be all over the place with their little, like, Disney lovers, like Disney anthropomorphic cartoon animal lovers.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, Dave Cat, about the boy toy line of real dolls.
Oh, yeah.
What do you think of that?
Yeah, they're very interesting. I'll tell you, it's like they actually have two different lines. There's the regular line with the larger anime-style eyes. And then there's, like, the Seasons line and the Customs line. I guess they've, you know, basically gone through the Seasons because there's only four of them. And they've, the Customs line. Which, the Customs line is interesting because it looks somewhere between the boy toys, like, kind of manga, anime, cartoony features and, like, the realistic features of a real doll. Personally,
to me, they look like Team America. The C-series? They look like Team America. They really do.
The kind of Jerry Anderson Super Variation kind of thing going there.
Yeah. You know, I honestly, like, I looked at the real doll. I have the real doll website memorized. I'm just fascinated. And you're right. There are male dolls.
Diana, I should start a fund with the listeners that we should get a real doll of you made and give it to you.
There you go.
I'm actually not the person to do that. But anyway.
We can make it Barbie style so you don't have to feel weird about that part.
I know people.
I'm obsessed. And, you know, you can have an avatar doll. You can have a doll with elf ears.
Oh, you can have an avatar doll? Is it to scale? Is it like 9 feet tall?
No, I don't think so.
Hold
a custom skin tone.
I'll tell you this, Diana. Actually, the AVN that I attended in January, I'd actually seen this doll that Abyss Creations had made. It was actually transparent.
Ooh, crazy.
Yeah.
I love it.
It was mental. Yeah, there was, like, veins and whatnot. There was, like, it was supposed to look a bit like a gynoid, kind of. Because there was, like, machinery inside her and whatnot. She had, like, tubes for hair and, like, neon lights inside her. It was pretty mental.
Oh, that's neat.
I'll just see if I can find some pictures for you.
No, I would love to, I'd love it. So email me, and maybe we'll even put it up on the podcast thing. But
yep. This podcast episode is going to be full of links and pictures. Yeah. It's going to be beautiful.
Yes,
definitely
got to
get a copy of those.
Yes. I did not get creeped out by the real dolls that look real. That didn't creep me out. Even the ones that are like smiling, you know, and they have the more realistic face. That did not bother me. But when I went to the boy toy stuff, I was like, I don't like this. There's something about this that I can't stomach. And I think maybe it was that it's got those childish or even maybe childlike
exaggerated
answers.
Or the idea that pedophiles would get child real dolls. I know Diana and I discussed that in one of our little Facebook chats. We were like, ew, what if somebody gets like a 10-year-old?
Yeah, and I know I've spoken actually with like people out of this. They're like, no, we won't do that sort of thing.
Well, that's cool that the manufacturers do the self-policing.
Yeah, which is good. But the thing is, it's very weird because like one of the ongoing debates that like you know pops in and out of like idolater culture really is that if we were to like make child dolls for pedophiles, would that stop pedophiles attacking from actual children? You know.
That's something that psychologists could actually examine. It would just be a matter of, they already do all kinds of neuroscience research on pedophiles in prison, and the pedophiles usually cooperate because they get like some kind of like benefits from it, like within the prison system. So it would really not be that hard. It would be one of those things Republicans would use to win elections. It's like my opponent wants to fund, you know, childlike love
dolls. And whatnot. The company that makes dolls should be burnt to the ground. Yeah. Bullet-like dolls should be burnt to the ground.
But
I think that's a really interesting question because it is kind of like a chicken and an egg question. It's like, would childlike dolls create pedophilia, or would they prevent it? Like, or were these people already pedophiles? But it's interesting because.
Yeah, I think it's down to the person, because, I mean, you know, I guess there's, like, you know, if you have a person that was, like, you know, made into a pedophile versus one that was, like, born one, it's just, you know, yeah, that's the only thing that you can really see through testing, but, again, it's a slippery slope.
Yeah, because you don't want to indulge people into worse behavior.
Absolutely.
But if you can give them an alternative... Yeah, if you can give them an alternative to bad behavior, so it is a risk, but it might be. I think it's one worth looking into at least. You know, like
the real beauty of this topic is that just in the amount of time we've been having this conversation, we've already envisioned so many potential research opportunities and philosophical opportunities for the use of synthetics.
Exactly.
One of the reasons I wanted to have you on is because I got that very easily from the documentary, and then when I saw your blog, it was like, oh no, yeah, this I totally get this, because you're like, your blog is a great news source for cutting edge robotics.
Thank you. Well, to be honest, I kind of get those from other blogs.
Well, I'm sure you do. You have your own style to it too. You have this kind of dark cyberpunk style. I know that you're a Throbbing Gristle fan because you were mourning the death of one of the members on your Twitter.
Yeah, I mean Throbbing Gristle was like one of the formative groups that I listened to back probably around. Well, it's like you know, it's like you listen to like setting the scene briefly because I do a lot of tangents. You know, I was listening to like you know Wham and George Michael and whatnot, like 84, 85, and then I started getting into the Human League and then the Smiths around high school, which had been in like 88, 89, thereabouts.
Those are great bands.
Yeah, and then there's like a finite number of like albums you can only buy from these groups, and then you start looking around, going, what else is out there? Okay, well, I like punk, I like the Sex Pistols, I like Clash. Is there anything harder out there? Throbbing Gristle. Let's see about them. Oh, they're on Mute. What else has Mute got? SPK, Hafler Trio? Let's look into them, you know. Then I moved on from them into Noise, like Maristown, Mazona, and White House.
I think that we definitely have some listeners that would sympathize with your taste in music all across that continuum. Hmm. Do you think But, you know, and this is related too, because like one of the things, like you, the experience you describe with finding underground music, and I have no doubt in my mind that this kind of like indie DIY culture thing is probably what led you to encounter the real doll.
Yes, no. Actually, one of my best friends had actually she had known that I was like fascinated with artificial humans, particularly artificial females, for years. And she was at work and like stumbled upon the real doll site and was just like, "You should probably come over and check this out." And I was just like, "Whoa! Oh my god!" Later, "Oh my god! They want $5,000. There's no way I'm gonna be able to."
That's one for the feminist, that it was a one of your female friends that introduced you to the love doll.
Yeah, people don't believe that. It's just like, yeah, she and I have known each other since 1980, and we're like practically brother and sister. And she was like, "Okay, well, you know, he's into his stuff, and you know, I'm into mine. So we, you know, we love and respect each other, but we know we have each other's quirks to keep in mind, you know, when we talk to each other." She loves Stephen King. I can't really stand him myself. So, but she was like, "Yeah, you know, I know you like mannequins, but I think this is a little better." And she showed me the site, and it was. So basically, you could blame her for
for the Dave Cat monster.
Yeah.
Well, I do have to ask you one annoying question, if you'll indulge me. One annoying question.
I will indulge.
And that's when I was reading Shishan's Twitter. I think it was her Twitter.
I didn't know Shishan had a Twitter.
Yeah.
Oh.
it said something about her being bisexual, and I just had to raise an eyebrow at that.
Just one eyebrow?
It's like... And
yes,
I was like, that seems like a very convenient personality quirk to enable polyamorous opportunities.
I am a heterosexual male. I'm sorry. I make no excuse for that.
Well, I mean, but do you see it as a polyamorous thing? Because polyamory is another. It's a philosophy. It's not just something to be taken lightly.
Well, that's the thing. It's like she used to actually have a site called Kitten with a Whip, and that actually went down around 2005. Because there was an article that went out. It was a really good article, but it was getting so many hits that it, like, more or less crashed the site. And I had, like, pulled it because I was just like, "Well, I got to redesign it anyway."
That's a good problem.
Yeah. Oh, God. But she used to have, like, a frequently asked questions thing. And, like, she had explained herself that, you know, she's 5'1", blah, 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 and bisexual. And then the follow-up question is like, "Wait, you're bisexual?" And I believe she had answered something along the lines of, "Well, I'm a doll, technically, but polysexual." No. Well, I'll tell you this. Well, I always say that my ideal would be to have about 8 dolls, you know, from various manufacturers. That way what I could do for Shouting to Hear the Echoes is actually have, like, a comparison thing where it's like, okay, well, I'm comparing a real doll to an AI doll or, like, an anatomical doll to, like, you know, a lovable doll or synthetic or whatever, you know. But the whole thing is that people will say, "Well, you know, so what would Shichan think of that?" Well, Shichan knows she's my wife. I only have one wife. I would only ever have one wife. It's just that, technically, if I got any dolls, they'd be for her. So.
Oh, that's a very interesting angle.
That's my loophole, and I'm sticking to it.
I totally value the richness of your mental life, Dave Cat. That is...
Keeps me off the streets. But then it's like, if I had multiple dolls too, it's like, I mean, I know several idolaters that actually have, I know one from Japan that's got like 25 dolls. I know another one that's got bordering on 40. And it's just like, I mean, that would be amazing just to have like 2-3 dolls and like a photo shoot, you know, doing stuff, you know, whether it be sexual or non-sexual, but you know.
I mean, would your supplementary dolls, would they have cool personalities too?
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, you know, I say I'd love to have 8, but then the thing is, it's like, I'd have to, like, sometimes I do admittedly struggle with, like, the bits that I write for Shichan. Sometimes it's like, okay, it's kind of difficult to write for her because, you know, if she were an organic, she'd be, like, you know, leaving the apartment, driving, get her laundry, know, doing this, doing that. But, you know, she stays in the apartment all the time. If you stay in one place all the time, it's awfully hard to, like, write about things because, well, you don't really do anything. So now and again, it's like, God, what would I say in this situation if I didn't leave?
Maybe you could try an exercise where you become Shishan during your activities.
You know, have her, like, bitching at me for, like, you know, leaving the window cracked and having it too cold in the apartment. So, like,
sure, why not? I mean, to a great extent, and I do not say this to downplay what you're doing, because clearly I admire what you're doing, and I see a lot of parallels between what you do with Shishan and what I do with my comic book art.
You have to get into the skin of your character.
Exactly, and so she is this kind of imaginary construct, and you can have her with you. I have a horde of imaginary constructs that I hang out with all the time.
That was one thing I wanted to ask you about, kind of a Fruity Duty question, but still, like, is she a character or is she like a fractalization of your personality? Like,
see, I'm sure that's the sort of thing that, like, a qualified professional could probably answer better than I could. It's like, I mean, the name alone.
Well, like it or not, Dave Cat, you are an experiment in philosophy of mind.
Well, for better or for worse, I'm sure. I'm setting standards. I'm breaking records. I'm shattering. I'm putting records back into their sleeves and putting them back on the shelves in which they belong. I'm sure on some level she is like a fractionalization, I guess, of a personality. So, you know, things that I can't myself realize being an African-American heterosexual male that, you know, it's like, well, if I were to expand on this, thinking it from the point of like someone who's not an African-American heterosexual male, well, what would this person do, you know? But it's, if it were like, you know, I guess percentile average, that, you know, fractionalization would be like maybe 20%, and the other 80% would be character. You know, Shichan is a character. But then I guess rolled into that 80%, you know, you can split that down the middle, which is where the bad math comes in. And basically say, yeah, she's a character, but she's also a partner. So,
well, you know, we're all characters. If you accept us, the field of social psychology is having any validity. And they do pretty rigorous experiments, and they deceive people so that they think they're being experimented on for something else, and they won't be paying attention to the thing they're looking at. And most of human personality is very, very fluctuating based on circumstance and situation, which shows us that we kind of do reinvent ourselves as characters regularly.
Yeah, and identity is
from one day to the next.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and identity is a modern concept, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, you know, it's the old saw, you know, who am I going to be today when I wake up and get out of bed? You know, am I going to be cranky? Am I going to be the benevolent person that says hi to everybody I meet? Am I going to be the person that wants to, like, throttle everybody I want to meet? You know, and that could change from day to day to hour to minute, you know, what have you.
I hope we're not causing too many existentialist crises. All three of us seem to be very comfortable with these things, but... But that brings me to another question. The Mindcore podcast, I haven't taken this. Diana and I, for one, don't see 100% eye to eye on this issue. But it used to be like an atheist propaganda podcast, and you yourself are an atheist. Could you speak to that a little bit? And you know, is it being an atheist like a non-issue for you? Is it something that like you are like concerned about, that it's an advocacy issue? Because I'm sure a lot of idolaters, as you call the community, probably do see you as a spokesperson and probably a pretty good one.
Yeah, well, it's I'm probably not as involved in like the whole atheist thing as I should be or could be at the very least. It's a bit of a non-issue. It's just like something I like come to the conclusion when I was sixth grade at a Catholic school. And it was just, there were like times where it just really stopped making sense to me. Especially when you look further and further into like the way like Judeo-Christianity is like set up, it's just, there's so many loopholes that it like just absolves anyone, especially anyone in positions of power, of any guilt. It's like, you know, go going on about, like, the whole, like, sexual predation that's going on with, like, you know, Catholic priests and whatnot. It's just like, well, you know, the Pope said, well, okay, that's a bad thing. However, we're not going to really punish these people. I mean, that's obviously not really a fault of the religion, per se. It's more a fault of, like, the people in charge of that religion.
Sure, but what, one could say that, you know, all the criticisms against the behavior of the clergy of all the religions of the world don't say one thing as to whether or not God exists.
Exactly. And then a large part of the problem I have with Christianity, Judeo-Christianity in general, is just, you know, the whole thing of our God is the best God and everybody else is, like, you know, going to hell. And it's just, what way is that to, like, treat other people on the same planet as yourself? It's a little exclusionary, you know?
Do you believe in a spirit or a soul?
Yeah, you definitely have a very soul questions of the soul kind of lifestyle.
Yeah, yeah. It's really interesting because it's like, as of late, I've been seeing that Shichan is more into the Shinto / animist thing. And me, I'm going, okay, well, I'm an atheist. You know, I don't really shout about it. I do say that, yes, I'm an atheist. But see, the whole thing with Shinto, as I mentioned before, is that, like, you know, the Shinto animist belief system believes that everything has its own spirit. And I guess that's my excuse for saying, well, this doll has a spirit of her own. So it's just, whether I believe in it or not, it's just, I don't want to say a loophole, but, you know.
No, I totally get it. It's a mental exercise. I one thing I would say, I mean, obviously you're into Japanese culture. Like, have you ever looked into Zen? I myself am a pretty ardent atheist, and I have, you know, I organize, like, political atheist and skeptical political activism occasionally, and I am I'm really into Zen. Japanese,
like, calms you down.
But it also it has a philosophical impact. Like, your relationship with Shishan would be very consistent with Zen, I would think, because you are fully aware at all times with your lifestyle that you are making all this stuff in your mind, and that your mind is like this great playground and like field where anything is possible. The Zen philosophy teaches that basically that mind is almost like it's something that you put things in, and that's the most fundamental truth of it.
I like that, because see, the thing is, I think a lot of people don't even, well, I mean, apart from not knowing about it, just don't even consider that. It's like, you know, you have a person that's sentient and whatnot, but they don't really, they're almost like hardcore focused on limiting themselves, you know. They don't really take the potential, like, I don't know, just think that, okay, a lot of the things I think are horribly serious and bad are just not really that serious. And, like, you know, something that can be glossed.
Sure, sure.
You know, it's like, there are people that I know that, like, have a lot of stuff going on in their lives, and it's just like, you know, you can either be the eye of the tornado, or you can be, like, in the midst of getting thrown around in 360 directions.
Yeah, yeah, and I see the value of that kind of thing, too, and I think that spiritual people, that's really what they work on, and I sometimes I wonder if it, I have this, I think it's also interesting that you figured out that you didn't believe in God when you were so young. Most of the atheists I meet are kind of like atheists since children. I'm one of these strange people. I was like a spiritual tourist. I've had like five or six religions. I have a religion now. I'm just, it's my synthetic religion. I have something like Shishan that's a religion I created in a comic book form for me to have as my own religion. And it's totally made up, and I talk about how fake it is all the time.
But hey, if it works for you, you know, I guess really with any religion, you know, or philosophy or any mindset, you know, I personally go by, if it harm none, do as thou wilt. You know?
Are you quoting Crowley?
I am in my own way quoting Crowley. Yeah. I mean, you could say he adds the Wiccan read, but yeah, every man and woman is a star, that sort of thing. But yeah, it's, you know, that's really what it is. If you're not hurting anyone, if you're not hurting yourself, then you should be able to do really whatever you want to do.
Amen.
So Crowley was definitely onto something.
Because we do this podcast, I try to check out podcasts like on everything basically, and they have the Thelema people, the Crowley people. They have a lot of stuff in cyberspace to promote their views, and I've recently gotten really into it. Like they always have really good musicians.
They had
only current 93. I'm telling you.
Yeah, and Amber Asylum. And even though these guys are such nerds, Dave Cat, you'd love this. They had Daniel Ash on their show, and he's not even a Crowley person. They're just like, we just think you're really cool, Daniel Ash. Tell us about your guitar. He's like, I think you guys are cool for liking Crowley and whatever, but I'm not into it. Yeah, he did. He just talked about his guitar and his motorcycle. And maybe he has kind of a synthetics approach to his guitar and his motorcycle.
Nice. See, there you go.
I think a lot of musicians might actually find that if they really search their minds, that a lot of them do have like a synthetics type relationship with their instrument.
Yeah, I mean, like Brian May. I was like reading on Wikipedia recently about Brian May and his Red Special Queen. I mean, he's had that guitar. I mean, he made the original Red Special probably when he's like probably getting the age wrong here, probably about 10 years old. I remember they were getting rid of an old fireplace, and he had used the wood from the fireplace to make the fretboard, and he used, like, a motorcycle part to make the tremolo bar. And he had, like, hand-built that guitar, and it was recently refinished, but, I mean, he loves that guitar. I mean, he had actually, like, declined to use it in a couple of videos that Queen had done, because there was this one song where, like, he throws the guitar to Freddie Mercury, and then Freddie, like, you know, kind of rocks out with it, and then throws it back to Brian. Brian was like, well, I don't want to use that because I want to have my guitar thrown. So he's like a new thing.
Oh, we have plenty of friends that are musicians, and we see all kinds of strange ritualistic behavior with their instruments.
You can't touch that one string, or, you know, that knob only has to be at this one setting forever. Oh, yeah.
And calling it baby, things like this, is not uncommon.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like a lot of people really personify a lot of things.
Yeah. But
I think the stigma is that since Nidaugder is personifying something that is person shaped, that's where it's just like, it hits a wall with a lot of people. Because, you know, you hear people talk about, oh, well, you know, I love my car and I rub it down with a diaper every day, and oh, my truck, or oh, my boat, or oh, my computer, or oh, whatever. You know, they personify things, you know, they give them names, and, you know, they even think, oh, God, you know, okay, don't worry, car, I'll get you some gas, or we'll get you an oil change, that sort of thing. People do it all the time. It's just that, you know, when they run across an idolater, you know, who has a doll, and it's like giving their doll a personality, it's just like, whoa, you're making a person. Yeah, wait a minute, but what's wrong with real people, you know? And there is just this, like, I guess, lack of imagination that just, like...
There you go. I think that really is the bottom line, is that if it's really something that enriches the mental experience, and the critics are the people who lack imagination, I think that's a good... If it's on that continuum, nobody... I think it's definitely a worthy enterprise, and that...
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, and, you know, as a, you know, a lady input, right? I love my animals like children.
See?
I'll admit to that. And most women will admit they have a little chihuahua like I do, but they love that thing like a little baby, and they call it baby, and they hold it like a baby, and they cook it special food and put it in clothes.
Mr. You know?
So who am I, as someone who dresses a dog, to judge anyone else? You know?
Well, we'll all be needing two plane tickets, one for me and one for Mr. Choo Choo. But there's nothing wrong with that. You know, it's long as it expands imagination and gets people to think in a creative manner. There should be absolutely nothing wrong with it.
It enriches life.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Although I do wonder... Do we have this privilege of imagination because of where we live and because of we have that sort of wealth in our lives? I mean, is this a product of, like, modernization and a certain amount of class, I guess, or having money? Or what do you think?
Say that. I don't know. You could – I would agree with that point. But then it's like you think of people that, like, you know – I mean, immediately when you were mentioning that, I was, like, thinking of, the Bronte sisters, awfully imaginative. And even, like, you know, as I was thinking of the Bronte sisters, it's like, I mean, look at, you know, an interesting a document as it is, look at the Bible. the Bible's got, like, a huge amount. I mean, one of my favorite books is Revelations, you know, followed by Song of Solomon. But that's incredibly imaginative work, right there. You really think that. I mean, you know, kind of finding that in, too, Christianity has produced a lot of amazing works of art, music, and architecture.
Primitive societies, too. Like, you can look at, like, stuff that the tribes people in Papua New Guinea make. They definitely make a lot of stuff that looks like people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's... I guess, you know, going back to, like, you know, where we are now in the 21st century, it's just like... even backtracking a bit to the 20th century. It's like, I don't know if you're familiar with Hans Bellmer, who was one of the first... Oh, okay, a better example. Oskar Kokoschka, who was an artist from post-World War I period. He actually created a replica of a woman that, like, he was in love with, but, like, had more or less spurned him and, like, left him for another man. And he had more or less created a doll version of her, Alma, as a matter of fact. And you think, well, you know, you hear all these people like, oh, well, you know, real dolls, you know, they're new and modern and whatnot. But then you think, real dolls in and of themselves have been around for just a couple of years, but the concept of, like, surrogate lovers or companions, good lord, that we're talking, like, hundreds, thousands, even, you know, possibly thousands.
All right, well, Dave Cat, well, we have one last question for you, which is that we want you to say more about basically your whole philosophy with synthetics and is it gynoids or gynoids?
You know, I've always heard it as gynoids. See, that's the thing. It's like I really have to learn the official IPA pronunciation code that Wikipedia has. Because, you know, it's like you see a bunch of symbols and you're like, I guess it's guy. You
know? Well, Diana has quite some experience with that kind of research stuff.
Well, I would think it would be gynoid because it's a gynecologist. So,
yeah.
But see, the thing is, it's, like, based on a Greek word, of course, like, for female, which is spelled G-U-N-E. So is it Gune? I don't know what's going
on. I'll have to do something
with Greeks, you know?
But basically that this your philosophy, your advocacy, your lifestyle, your art, You feel like you have a lot that there a lot of it is about like preserving imagination in your life and that like
yes.
A lot of people are robbed of their imagination and their ability to explore their imaginative side.
Yeah, I mean it sounds kind of like you know Peter Pan ish days. Like, yeah, you gotta have imagination, yay! You know, there is that, but it's just like I mean people get so bogged down with day-to-day affairs. I mean, I'm not saying ignore your day-to-day affairs because you want to go in your head. But the thing is, it's just you have to have, as a human being in this society in the 21st century, you have to have some sort of way to, like, you know, mentally let off some steam. And I think that's what a lot of detractors have against those who are idolaters because they have this way to not only sexually let off steam, but mentally they can do so as well. I mean, the older you get, the more it seems that, like, you know, people's imaginations are almost beaten up, you know? It's like you've, of course, got kids with their stuffed animals or the toys or whatever. They either give them personalities or they're just, like, their absolute favorite thing in the world and can't live without them. But you reach a certain age and it's like, no more. You're an adult now. And it's just, I'm not saying you can't be an adult, but I'm saying you can be an adult and still have some faculty that, you know, provides some sort of imaginative beats. And I think that's really important. Because, I mean, yeah, obviously with imagination, you know, you've got more artists, you've got more writers, you've got more, you know, playwrights, and it's just, you know.
And you have more innovation.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, people, you know, not to use a cliche, but thinking out of the box.
Yeah.
I personally believe that that's the one thing that society lacks the most and that really is the only thing that makes life worth living.
Yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, it's like, if you don't have some sort of imagination, then you're really just, shuffling through life existing. You're not living. No.
Well, those are very, very good final words for this episode.
You think that'll work? Awesome.
That will be very, very good.
Yes, thank you, Dave Cat. You were fabulous.
Thank you so much, and we will definitely have you back on if you are willing.
I'm more than willing. It really has been a pleasure, both to Diana and to Psychonauts. See, I got your name.
Psychonauts!
I hear you have a video game named after you.
I think I've accidentally named myself after the video game, but I will definitely have to check it out.
It was awesome. It's been a pleasure.
All right.